Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, September 12th, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria, coming at you from South Florida, sunny South Florida. I'm here in Fort Lauderdale, and I'm loving it. Adapting a little, still getting used to the new digs, still getting used to the new role as a psychology intern down here at Nova Southeastern University. So I'll be here for the next year. But the show shall go on, and I'm really excited about this week's episode. But before we get into it, I do want to, as I always do, thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible. I really do rely on the support from listeners just like you, especially because ad sales haven't been awesome this year, and I'm not sure if that is a function of where the economy is at, if it's a function of me being so busy that I haven't been pushing for more ads. I'm not really sure, but basically, we got to make sure that the podcast at least helps pay the bills, especially while I'm working for peanuts as an intern. And you guys really help with that so much. You make it so that I can take time, even though it's on top of my full-time schedule, to continue to produce the show. You know, I pay the editor to edit each week. I pay my assistant, Noelle, for booking and for doing a lot of the technical work around the show, which I just don't have the bandwidth for right now. So you guys make all of that possible. Anyway, enough about those logistics. I just want to thank you. And I want to give a shout out to the top patrons this week. They include Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, David Compton, Dudas Infinitas, Gabrielle F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, Joe Wilkinson, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Patrick Flynn, and Ulrika Hagman. Thank you all so, so much. And if you're interested in pledging your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. All righty, let's dive into this episode. So I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Jayshree Seth, and she is a corporate scientist at 3M, where she applies her scientific skills to developing, honestly, like the products that we all use, and we dive deep into what those are. She's trained as a chemical engineer, and she has her specialties, which we'll talk about. But the other cool thing is that her other title at 3M is Chief Science Advocate. That's her job. Like, she's a corporate scientist, and she's a chief science advocate. So, you know, a big part of her role is helping people of all ages, all around the world, learn to appreciate science and the role science plays in their everyday lives, which I think is just the coolest thing ever. She's a massive advocate for women in science, women in STEM, and there's just so many fun things that we talk about. So yeah, listen up, because it's a good one. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Jayshree Seth. Well, Jayshree, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Absolutely. I'm always excited when I have the opportunity to talk to a scientist, an engineer, somebody who works in industry, because I think that, and I don't know for the folks listening at home, how many of you actually formally studied science, but one of the big things that I often hear from my friends, peers, colleagues, individuals I interview on the show is that when we're kind of going through the motions of academic training, when we're in our, you know, college and postgrad degree programs, we don't often hear about industry opportunities. It's like academia is very academically focused. So most people who are going through the motions are like, oh, I guess I'm going to become a professor. I guess I'm going to become an engineer at a university, because the conversation outside of those kind of hallowed walls is not often emphasized as much. So I'm curious about your path, and I'm curious if that was also your experience before you decided to go into industry.
Mm-hmm. So where do you want me to start?
Anywhere that feels comfortable for you.
All right. So I guess the first thing I have to say is that when I was very young and, trying to figure out what it is that I would do, I really didn't think that science, technology, engineering, and math, that was my thing. But I grew up surrounded by scientists and engineers. My dad was a professor. We lived in a university town. This was the one of the most prestigious engineering institutions in India. And, you know, everyone wanted their kids to become engineers, you know, interestingly, sons and daughters. And it was primarily because the premier institution was right in town. So I was kind of encouraged to become an engineer. And I hadn't quite figured out what I wanted to do. There were not many, not even one, let's just be honest, engineer woman around. But, you know, I went along and, you know, I became an engineer and, you know, it wasn't in the hometown. I didn't get into that college, but I ended up becoming an engineer. And then it was, everybody was going for graduate school. So like you said, you know, you look around and that's the discussion that is happening. And I also applied and I got in and I came to the U.S. When I was here, finally, it was like, okay, is this what I want to do? And I didn't quite feel the connection with what I was doing. Just to explain for your listeners, I was working on modeling the growth of crystals in space. I just lacked the contextual understanding of how that would benefit people, because what is the implication of this? How is this important? And suddenly I found myself asking myself, you know, is this what you wanted to do? You were one of those who wanted to solve problems, help people, make the world a better place. And I had this, what I now know, and you will appreciate with your background, is this role incongruence in my head, communal goal incongruence. And so I decided to change from my master's to my PhD and went into an area where I could see that contextual importance of what I was doing. And that's where I really decided that, oh my gosh, I love this stuff. And I really felt like, yeah, I am somebody who can do this. So to me, that context was very, very critical. And then it just so happened that our advisor was somebody who really thought it was important to get internships and experience in industry. And it just so happened it was because he had ample industrial experience over the years collaborating with different industries. And so he was very particular about that. So, you know, one of my lab mates got an internship at 3M, and they came back and graduated and joined 3M, and they sort of reached out to the current students and said, you know, this would be something you should consider. So really, that's how I got the exposure. So it's really up to the lab leader, the advisor, who opens up this thinking for the students. And especially back in the day when we weren't reading as much and information wasn't as accessible, I think this experience at 3M that I had then as a summer intern was like, oh, this is great. And you're actually applying, you're actually doing things that you know exactly how they're helping the customer, you're solving problems, you're collaborating. I thought it was great. And then I got a job offer from 3M by the time I had interviewed at General Electric as well. And so I was pretty much on the path to an industrial role, if that helps answer the question. And so when I got the job offer at 3M, I was like, wow, this is great. I'm going to join. And I entered industry.
And you've been there since. I'm curious. I mean, you mentioned that you specifically had an advisor who had this kind of mindset and was very open in that way because they themselves had a lot of industry experience. Do you think that that is, how do I put this? Do you think that that's more common in chemical engineering than maybe in some other STEM fields?
I would say so. I don't know how it is now, but certainly in engineering, the industry connections and the network, I felt, was definitely there. Perhaps not so much as in core sciences, but in engineering for sure. But it also depends on the prevailing culture in that particular academic institution. Because I know at 3M, we have a lot of chemists and a lot of people who are working on, you know, material synthesis and stuff like that. And so they're not engineering, but they're, you know, we have core schools that we draw upon, and there's the strong relationships between advisors and the students who have graduated and joined different industries. And I think it's pretty prevalent in chemistry as well, but definitely in chemical engineering, we felt that.
And so I guess for those who are listening, and for myself too, for my own kind of increased knowledge, when we think about chemical engineering, I'm curious what the crossover is with, for example, material science, which is a field that I think some people listening right now would be familiar with. It's kind of a hot field and it's often covered in the news. What kind of crossover is there between those two?
Very large intersection set. Yeah, very large intersection set. So essentially, hardcore chemical engineering, I don't believe I've ever done. Once I got into research, it was all materials. And so what I do is essentially material science. And I would argue that virtually all the chemical engineers that I typically work with are largely materials-focused research is what they've done. Now, hardcore chemical engineering would be, you know, the big reactors and things like that. And we have those people as well because we have to scale up the materials that we make and they have to be done in those reactors. And, you know, some of the hardcore unit operations, we have those people too. But most of us that I deal with, we are materials folks. And I have to also emphasize that you don't learn everything in graduate school, right? You come to the industry and then you go, oh. So for example, something that I like to tell people is don't let that scare you because on-the-job learning is critical in these. I was working on diamond-like carbon film deposition for my PhD, and I came to 3M and I started working on diapers. Now, diamonds to diapers, literally. And I had never seen a diaper before. So I always joked, I've never seen a diamond either. So there, you know. But diapers are materials, right? And those materials need to be made. And diapers are just a phenomenal piece of engineering. It's a masterpiece with such an important job to do. And there were lots of polymeric, you know, components that we make at 3M that then the diaper manufacturers put in their diapers, you know, like the fasteners and things like that. And that was all polymers. And I had never, ever researched anything about polymers, didn't know anything about them, but you learn on the job, you know, and you have enough experts that you can work with to understand that. So even in our corporate lives, we have experts on these who are real polymer scientists. I'm in my division lab, so I'm more focused on taking the learnings and converting those into products, if you will. So I think it takes all types to come together and offer the innovation for our customers.
Absolutely. I mean, you're very much in an applied field, so much so that you have developed or you've been involved in the development of like several patents, right?
Yes, 76 to be precise.
76. It's so funny because the bio that I have for you says 75. So that means one of them has come through in between.
Yes, it was just last month that got another one. So yeah, 76 patent applications.
Amazing. And so are these all for products that are either in active development or ultimately, you know, may come to fruition, but all at 3M?
All at 3M, yes.
So, oh, very cool.
Yep. Some are ideas on things that we commercialize. Some we are in the process of. Some we never did, you know, but they're all innovations that were worth protecting for us.
So maybe for all of us who, you know, don't kind of peer behind the curtain very often, we think about a huge company like 3M and we see that logo stamped on all sorts of different products. But, you know, I'm not sure that we really understand kind of the depth and the breadth. I think of 3M, I think of office supplies, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, like, what is sort of the mandate? What is the core goal of the company? And what kinds of areas do you work on?
Yeah, we are literally in everything. I mean, we always like to say you're never, you know, more than 10 feet away from a product that has a 3M product in it, which is probably true right now where you sit. If you've got a phone or a piece of furniture or a laptop or anything that is around you. So our adhesives and tapes you know, you see the consumer stuff like the post-it notes and the scotch tape and the command hooks and things like that. But we also sell a lot to our industrial customers who then put it in their products. And then we sell it to automotive customers who put it in their product, the cars. We sell to electronics customers who put it in their devices. So we have a lot of that stuff that people don't see, but it's just, you know, different kinds of products like that. Then we have, you know, safety products, personal care products. We have your face masks and respirators and, you know, the N95s. That's a different part of the business. So we are in consumer. We are in transportation and electronics. We're in industrial and safety. And we are also in healthcare. But we recently announced that the healthcare part will be spun off. So it'll be an independent healthcare company.
Ah, gotcha, gotcha. And when it comes to transportation, you mentioned automotive, like that many of the things that you develop end up in different automobiles. Is that the bulk of the transportation business? Do you do any sort of aerospace work, or is it mostly
Absolutely.
Things? Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah. Aerospace, automotive, rails, tractor trailers, everything. We have products in,
cool.
in all of those. So lots and lots of industrial products through original equipment manufacturers, OEMs. So we supply to those. And then we are in things like diapers, you know, the diaper fasteners we supply to the manufacturers of diapers, and they integrate it into the diaper and that becomes your fastener.
And do you have your sort of, I guess, hands, maybe I should say your brain, across all of these different aspects of the company? Or is there a specific place that you focus your efforts?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently I am in what is called Industrial Adhesives and Tapes Division. So we develop adhesives and tapes for the industrial market, which is different from the consumer market, like we talked about. So the consumer things are things that you'll see like in an Office Depot or Office Max or Target or whatever. Ours is things that go into, you know, electronics or automotive or industrial applications. And I work on, you know, sustainable technology development for products that we can introduce in the industrial market. And I do have opportunity to look across the corporation because in my role as corporate scientist, so that's my official title. One of my official titles, I guess the second is chief science advocate, but a corporate scientist essentially means that you are at that level now that you can have a view of the entire corporation and what's going on and influence the strategies from a technical standpoint at that corporate level. So when I joined, I was working in that particular area, but as you rise up on the ladder, so as to speak, you can then have influence. And corporate scientist is the highest level that you can attain as a scientist at 3M.
Oh, that's so cool. And we'll talk about the kind of advocacy work in just a second. But I just wanted to point out to the listeners, I love it when this happens because we've been doing Talk Nerdy now for so long and we have so many episodes. I think this is going to be, I don't want to make any specific, I think it'll be like episode 423, maybe. So, you know, the many, many episodes before this. And I'm remembering when Lori Winkless was on the show earlier this year. She's a science writer, and her most recent book is called Sticky, and it's the science of surfaces and adhesion and adhesives and why things stick together and how things lubricate past each other. And it's really interesting to me when I have individuals on the show from like wildly different backgrounds who are talking about really similar things. And there's kind of that convergence there. So if anybody remembers that episode or they want to go back and review and listen to it, I can imagine that a lot of the principles that she writes about in her book are principles not only that you learned about in school, but that you are actively developing, or maybe I should say utilizing in the work that you do. It's fascinating. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that we take for granted. I mean, we sometimes joke that, you know, you look at your iPhone or whatever that's in your hand and you like completely take for granted the amazing engineering and the elegance and the technology that goes into it. But I would say that we probably take that for granted less than we take for granted the engineering that goes into even more everyday objects, that we kind of assume we're like born that way. You know, like this table just fell out of the sky this way. It's like, no, this was an engineered product.
Right, right. And it's just fascinating. And once you start peeling, as you said, Because you have to bond to surfaces and they may be very dissimilar, and then it's going to go underwater, or then it's going to be exposed to this temperature, or it's going to be in a warehouse that is as minus 40. It's going to sit in a car that's going to heat up in Arizona. Oh, it's going to go on the ocean and reach China. So just the amount of diversity in that problem set itself is so tremendous. And then how thick can you have it? And what is it? How thin do you need to be? Can you coat that thick? Can you coat that thin? All those kinds of things. It's just a fascinating area, each one of them, not just adhesives, but every single thing, when you start appreciating the beauty of the detail that goes into it to make the final innovation in your hand happen.
Absolutely. And of course, you offered me the most beautiful transition there, because you were talking about the kind of diversity of the problems that you're trying to solve. And of course, a diversity of problems requires a diversity of perspectives to solve them. And so I would love to maybe take a little bit of a turn for a second and talk about the work that you do both within 3M and also outside of it, in your science advocacy and your promotion, your science communication, your promotion of STEM, especially for women, for individuals of color. I want to know, how did you first start sort of making that transition? Or was it something you always cared about even before you entered the company?
Well, it's interesting. I was in 2018 asked to take on this role of chief science advocate at 3M. And, if you Google this role, it doesn't exist anywhere. So I was like, wait a minute, what is this role now? Because there was nobody in this role. I can't see this role anywhere in any company. So what is this about? And then I find out that, we have done this survey to understand the global perception of science. And the results are quite jaw-dropping. 4 out of 10 said if science didn't exist, their lives would be no different.
What?
Are
you serious?
Exactly. Yeah, that was my reaction. Thank you very much for validating my reaction. And then 32% of people call themselves science skeptics. And in that population, 6 out of 10 said if science didn't exist, their lives would be no different, And I was like, wait a minute, how did you ask? Who did you ask? How did you run the survey? What were they thinking? Da, 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 and all of that. But then quickly you realize their perception is their reality. It doesn't matter how science was defined, what it was. This is how people are reacting. And the reason we do this survey or did this was because we are all about science, and we, science matters to us. And we thought, let's just see, I'm sure people care about science. And this was 1,000 respondents per country, 14 countries, and this is the result. And so it was decided that we need to step up and advocate for science. This isn't some data that we can keep close to our vest, because this impacts everybody. And we wanted to foster a global conversation. So they reached out to me and said, you have to take this role. And I was like, look, I gotta tell you something, guys. I wasn't a science and engineering kid. Like, I wasn't the one who grew up thinking, I'm gonna be an engineer. Like, far from it. So I just want to let you know that, And they were like, no. And then it turned out just my journey itself inspired me to do this, because I'm thinking, I'm pretty good at science, but I wasn't the one who thought this is what I wanted to do. Why is that? Because I lacked the context. I really lacked the context of how it helped people, how it improved lives, how it really made me feel like I was doing something important. It was talked about in such a dry manner and taught, frankly, in such a dry manner. Then I realized that this is something that I can bring in, because I should mention, Kara, about the same time I had 2 kids, a son and a daughter, and I could clearly see how the content was sufficient for my son to be excited. My daughter always wanted the context. The why are we doing this? Why is this important? How does this help people? And I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, maybe it's a lot more girls who think contextually. So I started reading about social sciences and work that has been done on how different things are perceived. And I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, I will be the science advocate that you're asking me to be, but I will bring my story into it saying, I'm not the one who, was always wanted to be a scientist. I'm not the one who went to top colleges. I came into 3M through the back door as a summer intern. But listen, I'm at the highest level today that you can achieve. I have 76 patents. I've been awarded the highest achievement award by Society of Women Engineers. I am, at the top, you would imagine. But it's only because I understood the context of what we're doing. So we have to change the way we teach, the way we track, the way we talk, the way we even typify STEM if we want to inspire more girls and more underrepresented minorities. So that kind of became my, cornerstone of my advocacy work, because to me, it was very important that I talk about my story. And it just opened up this opportunity because I realized so many people think about it that way. So many girls we lose because we don't talk about the context of what is important.
Absolutely.
So that's how I'm in this role. Mm-hmm.
There's so much to unpack there. I mean, so many kind of things come up for me as you talk about that, parallels that I find in my own career, being somebody who very similar to you, and maybe for different reasons, maybe for some crossover, but had that, when I was quite young, science was not even on my radar. It was definitely not an area that I planned to study. And it didn't feel within reach for me. Like, it felt difficult and esoteric and cold and like something that wouldn't feel natural. And therefore, I might not want to take the time to get on the other side of it. But even beyond that, this conversation that you mentioned about how science was taught in school and how you saw that your son really took to it, but your daughter needed some of that context. And you can't help but realize, like, well, the reason that boys very often, and this is not always the case, obviously, but very, very often, and we have good evidence to show this, the reason that boys take to it so young is not because of some sort of inherent skill. It's not because of some genetic predisposition. It's because men have always been the ones teaching science. It's because science has always been a boys' club. And so long as science historically was taught by a very particular or through a very particular perspective, it was always going to be interesting to that same perspective generation after generation.
Yeah, I think that plays a role. I think there's also the way people think. There's a lot of research on that. I mean, and the way you talk about a subject and who gets excited. I think there's a famous study by Girl Scouts, I think, where they asked, who wants to help people, who wants to, provide clean water, who wants to do all of that. And the girls were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But when you twist it around and you talk about it from a content perspective, who wants to build a filter or whatever, you are going to lose the girls because they're inspired by the context, but it's communicated in such a content-based style. Another one was where they said, okay, we're going to introduce I may not be giving the exact story, but you'll get the point, is who wants to have a crypto badge or a, privacy and cybersecurity badge. And the girls didn't sign up for that. But when they said, who wants to protect their grandparents from scammers online, girls were super interested in that. And it was the same badge, but you're talking about a cybersecurity badge in two different ways. And it's just that the context is important. And like you said, if it's taught by people who are content focused, the subject is written the way it is, very content focused, less and less discussion of context, you will lose a lot of people. And I think context and the community oriented aspect of that, I think, is critical for getting the underrepresented minorities excited as well. And I know for a fact that when I'm inspired by the context, the content just comes along for the ride. It's no big deal, but I need to be inspired by the context of what I'm doing.
Right. Like, the how isn't as important, or it doesn't feel as alive as the why. So when you have the why, then the how starts to make a lot more sense. And it feels necessary, it feels natural. And kind of to the point that you made, you know, until or unless there are people, and not just people kind of doing the work, but people in positions of power, in positions of authority. So more like the stakeholders and the decision makers than necessarily just the individuals who are boots on the ground. Until those stakeholders and decision makers come from various backgrounds, we will not have various perspectives in the conversation. So we will constantly have this like worrisome trickle-down effect where only the most privileged or only the most narrow views are being perpetuated over and over and over. And then what ends up happening is you have this almost necessary, this obvious following of a club, you know, a club where some people are in and some people are out. And sadly, I think what ends up happening is when you don't have the context, speaking of context and content, when you don't have that broader picture and the context, at the surface, it almost seems as though, and you see people advocating for these perspectives very often, it almost seems as though it's like, oh, well, maybe just some of these people are, you know, it's just not interesting to them. It's just, they're just not that good at this. It's like, no. It's because they've been kept out of the conversation.
Yep. No, that's exactly the kind of discussions that we had. And when we launched our docuseries, you know, called Not the Science Type. That was the whole idea, is that we have to show diverse role models and everybody coming at it, you know, a different way. You know, in my case, somebody who didn't think of themselves as the science and engineering type, but came into it and did all right. You know, we had four women highlighted in this. So it was really an honor to be part of that team, because we want to say exactly that. Don't let pervasive stereotypes about, you know, what science is and what scientists do and who enters and who persists and who excels in STEM deter you, because we need this this diversity. So, and we need you to be you, you know, that's what you bring to this.
Right. Not to kind of bend and mold yourself into that perspective or that shape that sort of preceded you. The whole point is to broaden. And so tell us a little more about Not the Science Type. So you, what was your role in it? Were you only featured? Were you involved behind the scenes?
It was basically highlights the journey of four women, you know, who have, you know, challenged stereotypes and pursued STEM. So we have, you know, Gitanjali Rao, who is a kid inventor, really. Her path crossed through 3M. Actually, she was the young scientist challenge winner, you know, quite a few years back. And then she has really gone on to do some great things. And so she pursued her passion of problem solving, and it started at a really young age. And so we have her story highlighted. We have Sierra Sevils, who blazed trails in her field. She was the first Black nuclear engineer from UMich. And, you know, we talk about her journey that her teacher inspired her to, you know, think big and, you know, apply to MIT and things like that, which she had never thought of, you know, so the role of the teacher there. And then we had Jessica Taff, who shaped her career, and she brought her interest in global health into the part of what she was doing, because she wanted to exactly shape, not just fall into the track of, like you said, what is preceded you. And then I brought my interest in humanities, you know, and I had a very strong interest in humanities. And but because of strong parental encouragement and where I grew up, I was encouraged to pursue STEM, but I've never given up my interest. And I bring it in the job that I do and every project that I have. And I see the value that it brings. I, in fact, like to say the real shtick is STEM, science, humanities, technology, engineering, and math. And that's what makes it. So that, you know, the reason we made that docuseries is because some of our data also shows that everybody agrees, you know, 88%, I believe it was, said that we need more diversity in STEM. We need more women and underrepresented minorities. We need to do more to engage them. I think it was 70% of the world that believes there'll be negative consequences if we fail to attract more women and girls to science, you know. So, and, you know, we understood that there's something we have to do. And there's a lot of research out there on positive impact of role models. And the negative impact of stereotypes. So we wanted to address that. And film is such a powerful medium for shaping societal views and public opinion and the cultural landscape. And during the pandemic, you saw that documentaries were getting a lot of attention. So, and that's what we're trying to achieve with this film. We want to emphasize that there's a need for diversity in STEM. There's a need to dismantle stereotypes and really the need to inspire young women, you know, like my daughter. So, and we want to normalize the strong participation of diverse women in STEM fields. That's
Yeah, absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. There is something really powerful about this visual medium to tell a story that, I mean, it's almost like we were talking about earlier about content and context. When you tell a story through this sort of visual medium, you get a lot of context. It feels like the why is front and center. And I have to point out too, just for the listeners, that Jessica Taff is also a previous guest on Talk Nerdy. Oh. So you can definitely pull up that episode and listen to her story as well.
Yes.
And now I got to get the other two on the show. Now I'm feeling really inspired. And so where can people check out the docuseries?
Yeah, it's at 3m.com/NotTheScienceType. I would really encourage your listeners to watch. It's a short segments on all four, about 7 to 8 minutes. So the full thing, it doesn't take much time at all. And you never know who you can send it to and have them be inspired, you know. So all different kinds of stories in there. And sometimes people just find themselves in it and say, yeah, I can do this because such and thus did. And different people get different things out of that. You know, and even for, I wouldn't say it's just for women, it's for boys, it's for everybody to just see that because.
I agree wholeheartedly. And I think that's something that we don't kind of talk about enough is that representation, obviously, and role modeling absolutely matters for the individuals who are underrepresented in fields, because of course, unless you can see yourself in somebody doing something, it's very difficult to imagine that it is for you, right? If you can see it, you can be it. But at the same time, we often leave the part of the equation out that it's important for young boys to see girls being role modeled. It's important for boys to see women, you know, the role of women in industry, the role of women in these positions of power being normalized.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And unless we do that, we're going to be constantly swimming upstream, right? We need to like really see the current and be able to kind of to change that that conversation. And so it sounds like the work that you're doing, both kind of behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, is really encouraging that. And it's not just the docuseries. You've also written two different books. Did you write them both during your time at 3M?
Yeah, it was actually in the last 2 years. So
wow, you've been busy.
Yeah, it was in 2020 when the you know, the pandemic is full swing, and then the social justice, just the raw and revealing nature of what was happening on the world stage. And I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it happened in Minneapolis. So that was just quite the jarring experience to see, you know, and dig deeper and try to understand all the structural inequities and things like that. And I just had the strong desire to do something. And, you know, what can I do? Just me, even. What can I do? And so what I did is essentially took a bunch of essays that I've written on all different kinds of topics and wrote a few more, and we compiled it publisher is the Society of Women Engineers, and all the proceeds go for a scholarship for underrepresented minority women in STEM, so Black, Latinx, Indigenous. And, you know, the first scholarship was awarded, and the student, a young Black woman who's going to Georgia Tech, and it just so happens that I get invited. My first travel in 2021 was to Georgia Tech, I get invited to present the Silas Ethics Lecture there. And I was just like, this is a sign. I mean, of all the places where the student could be going, they're exactly at the same place. All the invitations I could possibly get, I get this one. I was so excited to meet her, Kara. It was like, oh my gosh. You know, somehow you feel like you did something and then everybody supported it. People bought the book and here we are. We're supporting somebody's journey. So on that flight back itself, I texted to my husband. It's like, I can't stop here. I got to do something. And so I did another one. And this was more about the transitions and the reflections and the actions that we can take, you know, just living through that pandemic and everything that changed around us. There was just immense change at that time. And I just wanted to focus on that. So I basically, the second book is, it, you know, that realization that I had that regardless of what educational path we follow, what career we end up in, you know, real growth, true leadership, self-actualization, it comes from, you know, getting in touch with our feelings and dissecting them, understanding our sense of identity and its evolution. And we are evolving. We did tremendously during the pandemic, tapping into our needs at a very innate sort of human level, and then integrating our learnings with our lived experience to work through these, you know, tough transitions, deep reflections, and then meaningful actions. So that's just what the second book is about. So again, all proceeds go for a scholarship for underrepresented minority women. And it was also published by SWE, the Society of Women Engineers, the second book as well. So the first one is The Heart of Science, Engineering Footprints, Fingerprints, and Imprints. So I write about things that you do, the paths you take, and the mark you leave. And so walk through a bunch of essays on topics that relate to that. And then the second one is The Heart of Science, Engineering Fine Print. And this is more about the reflections and the actions that we can all take.
I love that. I mean, you're really speaking sort of my language and something that's after my own heart as somebody that I would probably describe myself as a humanist, you know, as I work in existential psychotherapy. I work in care for individuals with life-limiting illnesses, end-of-life care, psycho-oncology. And in order to do that kind of work, clearly this very humanistic perspective is necessary. But I think that in every aspect of STEM, even what we often think about as some of the hardest of the hard sciences, computer sciences, chemical engineering, you know, nuclear physics. These things are not divorced from humanity. They are actually fundamentally intertwined with humanity. In order to develop computer vision, you have to understand how people are seen and what the, you know, microaggressions and the biases that they deal with are regularly. In order to develop something like a fuel that can hopefully power the necessary technology to keep ourselves alive and healthy and happy, we have to understand the needs of individuals. And we also have to understand, you know, that we're only as strong as the weakest among us. And how can we best serve those individuals who are struggling the most? And I think that we really do ourselves a disservice very often in STEM fields by teaching these things in such a way that they're divorced from the people who do them and from the people whom they benefit.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think that human context is key. Science itself is such a human endeavor. And the more we do in our advocacy or even in your functional roles of connecting STEM to the human context, the more people we will pull into our fold, because, you know, we need more science. Yes, we need more people in science, but we also need people who can support science. We need people who are more science-minded. We need more people, like you mentioned, your listeners, who are science enthusiasts. We need those who can communicate social benefits of science. So we need all that. And that only comes, I believe, if we make it more of a human endeavor that it is and talk about it that way. And even if people are in science, I tell people that the public should see the science community engaged with the community at large, because it's good for science, it's good for the scientists, and it's good for the community.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, whether we're talking about a very obvious outcome, which is, you know, a scientifically literate voting populace, right? People who can make informed decisions and can make those informed decisions at the polls and directly influence policy so that it's evidence-based. You know, that's a very kind of obvious outcome of good science evangelism or science communication or science advocacy, whatever you want to call it. But even down to As you mentioned, just sort of the general culture, the way that the wind blows, because we know that we're in a crisis right now. We know that there is literally a reality crisis, that there are individuals, unfortunately, sometimes individuals with political power, but definitely individuals with loud voices on the internet who are reaching many, many people who are denying reality, who are denying, pretty, you know, consensus, like scientific consensus. And the only way we're going to fight against that is to make that a fringe viewpoint and to continue to empower and to advocate for prioritizing truth, reality, whether that be from a philosophic perspective and whether we're, you know, arguing about constructivism and these very philosophical views. I think we all kind of agree on, you know, basic scientific findings. So when people don't agree on that, it's a failure. It's a failure of us to communicate, and it's a failure of society to, I think, prioritize these things. So we've now more than ever, we have to work harder.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the last few years have clearly shown us that there is an urgent need for a broader perspective and sort of a social context for science. And, you know, we can do that by building a more diverse science community and science itself as a more inclusive space, because that narrow view that we talked about, the narrow view of science will make science itself vulnerable.
It does. I mean, I think that one of the outcomes that we often see, and it makes perfect sense, is when we see, and I don't like to use the word skepticism because I also identify as a scientific skeptic. And in that context, I mean, I am an evidence-based thinker. So I more like to use the word like denialism or maybe even distrust. But we see what we often might label as prudent paranoia, especially within ethnic minority communities, underrepresented communities, where there's a good reason to be distrustful, let's say, of a medical institution or of a certain type of industrial technology because of the harms that have been perpetrated by it in the past. And so it does not behoove us to continue to remain siloed. The only way we're going to solve these historical, or I should say right these historical wrongs, are to include the very voices who have been wronged to learn how to right them. And so there's a very good reason that some people are distrustful of maybe not the process of science, but the outcomes of that process.
Right. And this is a great time because, you know, the survey that I talked about, the State of Science Index that we do at 3M, mm-hmm. and we've been doing it since 2018. And it was interesting that before the pandemic, the trust was being eroded and, skepticism was higher. And with the pandemic, suddenly trust went up, skepticism stayed low. And so with that experience, people saw that science delivered. And this is a moment. Science is literally having its moment, is what we like to say. And so this is the time to sort of fortify and bolster that public trust and say, yes, we had this issue. Science was center stage. Scientists were center stage, finding, you know, cures and developing therapies and models and things, this and that. So I think sometimes we only hear from a very small but very vocal community. It's important to show the data that clearly shows globally, you know, 17 countries now, and the trust in science remains high and skepticism is low. But sure enough, it'll start, you know, going the different direction when the pandemic is forgotten or whatever. So that's the nice thing, is people have made the connection in science ability to solve problems. So it's been linked with sustainability. It's been linked with social justice. It's been linked. So it's a wonderful time, actually, because people are understanding that environments that, you know, sort of lack that diversity can become echo chambers, you know, where the same voices will continue to reflect and reverberate. And, you know, people understand that we need to facilitate more diversity and foster inclusion and further the cause of equity. And that's why a lot of people are digging into their own pockets of privilege and find ways to contribute and make this different, because everybody recognizes our world requires innovation. Innovation needs science. Science demands diversity, and diversity warrants equity.
And what an important kind of insight that you made just then about sort of being in the face of crisis or being in the face of tragedy and really digging deep and recognizing what are our foundations? What do we rely on? What can we trust? How do we feel strong under our feet? And science really does, science technology, the scientific process, the method itself really does offer that sort of in some ways, maybe that comfort or at least that reassurance. And I speak personally because it reminds me, I find all these like weird parallels in the way that I think, but it reminds me of my recent experience. I recently had a pretty invasive surgery after a cancer diagnosis. And I remember while I was healing, it was only 6 weeks ago, but during the immediate aftermath, when I was healing from, I had a laparoscopic hysterectomy, the first couple weeks, there was a lot of pain and there was a lot of disability. And I remember thinking to myself, I will never again take advantage of, or I will never again take for granted my health, my mobility, I was like, oh, if only I could just do yoga right now. If only I could just touch my toes. If only I could just lift something that weighed more than 2 pounds. And how quickly, now that it's 6 weeks, 7 weeks out, and it's easy again for me to bend and stretch and lift something, how quickly I forgot and have to constantly remind myself, remember what it was like when you couldn't do that. This is such a thing to be grateful for. And I think that really speaks to sort of the human condition that we, when everything is okay and going well, it's so easy to take for granted all the reasons that it's okay and going well. The technology in the phone in our pocket, the technology in the desk in front of us. But we have to have these moments of gratitude, these meditative, insightful moments where we remember how we got here, why we got here, and how quickly and easily it can be taken away. And of course, our brothers and sisters in Ukraine right now are recognizing that day to day. Individuals across the world who are dealing with conflict, with famine, with, natural disasters, with the problems that face humanity are clearly appreciating that. But we very often here in the West, I think, have the privilege to forget. And we have to remember. And I think science helps us remember.
Yep. No, I think the whole idea of science was so taken for granted, so behind the scenes and so underappreciated, that all changed. It's not a great thing that it took a pandemic to do that. But now that we have achieved this position, I suppose, where people are accepting of science and understanding that, oh my gosh, yeah, that saved us literally, when virtually all of humanity, we were facing the same existential crisis, confronting the same fears and all awaiting our turn for the gift of science and the vaccine. So let's use that moment. And we see that the public is recognizing that science is important for solving sustainability challenges. Science is important for solving social justice challenges. So people are seeing the connection. And the more we can fortify that and show how the sustainability challenges can be confronted, and we'll need the support to be solved, and we will need. I think it's important to do that and sustain this momentum that science seems to have gained with the experience of experiencing the pandemic. And it's like you said, it's no longer just the practice of science, but people are questioning who are the practitioners. It's not just the policy, but the politics, and it's not just the people. It's also their perceptions that can lead to the, action or inaction, as we saw. So we need to address that. It's not enough just to do the science,
Yeah, and I think it's also so important that science is more than just a body of knowledge, and it's more than just a method, but it really is a mindset. And we can apply scientific thinking, this combination of sort of, as I like to say, skepticism and open-mindedness, which almost sound like opposites, but they're really not. They're both necessary to do good science. We can apply a scientific mindset to anything and everything, to social justice issues, as you mentioned, to very human issues. And maybe we're not going to always be able to do a randomized controlled trial. And maybe, you know, we're going to have to adapt our scientific thinking for the problem at hand. But if we can think scientifically as a populace, I think that we will be empowered to affect change in a really beautiful way, because it's an ever-evolving process. And it's one that has kind of withstood the test of time from ancient philosophers forward. We have always been developing the scientific method, and we have always been iterating it to advance our understanding and our knowledge. And so, you know, I wish I could keep you all day. Of course I can't, because you have to get back to work and do all the things that are so important. But I was curious if I could ask you, as we kind of close out the episode, Jayashree, the same two questions that I ask everyone who I have on the show. They're sort of really big picture, maybe more personal or philosophical questions. I don't know if I'm ever going to do anything. Maybe I'll compile everybody's answers one of these days, but I'm always curious how my different guests, where their perspectives come in. So what do you say? Big picture questions, you ready for them?
Okay, let's go.
All right. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context feels relevant to you right now as you sit here with me. So this could be personal, familial, it could be vocational, it could be communal, it could be global, it could be cosmic. When you think about the future, basically I'm going to ask you two different things. The first is, what is keeping you up the most at night? The thing that is most disconcerting? Maybe where are you finding your pessimism, even your cynicism? What are you really worried about? But then on the flip side of that, to end on a more, you know, positive note, where are you hopeful? You know, genuinely, authentically, where are you finding your optimism? What are you looking forward to?
Interesting big picture questions. I'd say what I worry about is the erosion of trust in our systems, in relationships, in the way we view the world. There just seems to be this acceleration, or maybe it just seems that way. Is it real? I'm not so sure. But it seems to be that there is an erosion of trust in basic systems. And that concerns me a little bit, because I think the foundation, trust is the foundation of a lot of things that we know how to do and how to operate. So sometimes I worry if it's just a perception, or is it really happening? But then you see all these different things going on around the world, and you realize that there perhaps is an attack on really the trust that allows human beings to function effectively. So that's the one thing that I worry about, is that where are we headed if we have the continued erosion of trust with everything, and even little questions that we shouldn't be questioning. But on the flip side, I feel very hopeful when I interact with the youth and their views and the lens they bring. And I learned so much from my now adult kids that it's just, it just gives you different perspective, and it just, you learn to appreciate different viewpoints, and then you learn to question your own viewpoint, and then you learn to create a new perspective. I think those are really what makes you optimistic is even at the age that I am, and you think you know what you're talking about, and then you have a discussion with your kids and you are willing to change your mind about things and just be opened up to these different options. I think that makes me optimistic that despite, I guess, you know, erosion of trust, if it's real and all those things, I think if we truly listen and try to understand each other's perspective, I think there's reason for optimism.
Oh, and I wholeheartedly agree. And it's interesting because I feel like you really beautifully encapsulated what I often think of as progress. You know, I kind of describe myself as progressive, whether that's politically or philosophically, however you want to define it. But progress to me is not accomplishment. It's not bigger, better, more. You know, it's not a sort of kind of capitalist gain. Progress to me is moral progress. It's social progress. It's what happens when, like you said, we listen. What happens when we open our minds and we include more and more and more voices, and eventually all of the voices that exist are part of the conversation. That to me is progress, and it's such a beautiful goal. And I think that it's undeniable that as we look back on the sort of, you know, as Dr. King said, the sort of like moral arc of history, it is bending towards, you know, justice, towards progress, towards change, and change for the better. And that keeps me very hopeful as well. So
yeah, gosh, I really like that topic of change and using your voice and all of that. So I would encourage your listeners to follow me on LinkedIn. I write about these topics quite a bit, and I'd love feedback.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. And obviously check out both the docu-series, Not the Science Type, and of course, both books, The Heart of Science, Engineering Footprints, Fingerprints, and Imprints, and The Heart of Science, Engineering Fine Print.
For your enthusiasts, I would also encourage them to go to 3m.com/scienceindex and actually look at the results of our survey. It's a very interactive website. You can look at all different years, different areas, demographics, slice dice, and have fun.
Oh, yeah. So you said that was 3m.com/scienceindex. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, gosh, Dr. Seth, thank you so much for spending time with us today, for enlightening us. It was really, I think, an inspiring, interesting, fascinating, but also a really inspiring chat. So I'm just really appreciative that you took the time.
Thank you. I'm so glad we could fit it in. And please take care. Hearing about the health issues you had, so may you prevail.
Oh, thank you so much. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.